welcome to Series 3 of the Decoding Culture podcast. I have some really exciting guests in this series that can help us understand the importance that culture plays in all areas of business and society, from how it shapes organisations and work to how it influences consumer experience, innovation, design and larger societal trends. My name is John Curran and I'm your host. I'm a business anthropologist, executive coach and team coach, facilitator and trainer. As a coach, one of the central tools you have is to listen. Some call this active listening. But listening is not easy and something one has to practice, because fundamentally you are listening to not just what people are saying, but also what they're not saying. Listening is therefore a holistic endeavor that is more an art than a technique. As an anthropologist, I'm also taught to listen to silence. Or as the anthropologist and FT journalist Gillian Tett describes, listening to social silence. But why is the ability to listen so important to understanding everyday culture and society? Well, to help me unpack this, I spoke with Professor Les Back, who is Professor of Sociology at Goldsmiths University in London. Les has written a fascinating book called The Art of Listening, and he shows how by adopting a sociological mindset, one can uncover many rich components of culture through listening. This was my first in-person podcast recording for nearly 2 years, and I met Les at Goldsmiths University in London. What became clear as we talked was that listening is not static, or it's not just a two-way process. There are multiple components to it. He also introduced me to the concept of sociological walking. Here we spend time listening to the city of London, both from above and on the street level. And so fascinating was the discussion that I've decided to divide our podcast into two episodes, one on listening and one on the sociological aspects of walking. Hi, Les, and welcome to Decoding Culture Podcast.
Ah, thank you for having me on. It's great to see you. We're old friends, obviously. The listeners won't know that, but we are. I'm really glad to be involved.
Fantastic. Well, we're sitting in your office here at Goldsmiths College, London University, which is in South London, in an area called New Cross. And outside on the street, we've got Victorian houses here, and I hear students talking and chattering, and it's representing the fact that this is the first podcast in 2 years I've done that's actually, I dare say, face-to-face. It's actually almost body-to-body.
Great. Isn't that wonderful? How much we've missed it? Yeah, you know, I think as well, the kind of work that I've done, it should be no surprise to you, is very much of a place. I feel myself as an intellectual that has a place, that operates out of a place, you know. And we're sitting in this office, which is in the old Laurie Grove Baths, which was a wash house. The American viewers might not know this, but in the Victorian era, one of the ways of dealing with another pandemic, cholera, was to try and clean up the great unwashed of South London and working people, both in terms of washing clothes, but washing bodies as well. So this was a bathhouse where people came to get clean. In fact, the room that we're in is one of the bedrooms of the bathhouse manager. A family lived here. So it's a very historic place, and it has a great resonance, if you like, with the kinds of interests that I've had in understanding city life and urban culture, and attuning our attention to the dynamics, both economically, politically, socially, of city life.
That almost kind of made me think. I just wondered if Zoom was around then. What would it have been like in the time, you know? Because I mean, in a way, it's kind of framed us. That kind of, you know, I had to change how I introduced this by saying, well, actually, We've been programmed that we are face to face with Zoom, and now, but we're actually body to body. You know, it's a very different
experience. I mean, I think the pandemic has both made us think harder about the nature of the social in our time, but also it's made us really reflect on the things that we miss. So where we're talking now is where I recorded all my lectures. You can see that I've sort of set up my office a little bit like a film set. Yeah. You know, my daughters like to tease me, saying that, you know, I've set this office up a little bit like the equivalent of Wayne's World basement. You know, I haven't got a theme tune, but I have got a sort of a look. So there's a camera on top of the computer there and lighting and stuff. So yeah I've done all of my teaching and my contact with students from this room.
Right, so it's, yeah. Well, about you and teaching, and you're a professor of sociology
I find it hard to believe that still, John, but
well,
yeah,
you have been
believe
for,
you.
You have been for many a year, which and importantly, so just for the listeners, your journey into academia, because you started actually in anthropology and then moved into, but just tell us a bit about your journey, your interests in academia.
Well, it's a strange, I kind of got into academia through the back door. That's not just trying to be cool, it's just true, actually, you know. So I was the first in my family to come to university. I grew up in Croydon, which is about, you know, 10 miles from here, quite close by. I came to Goldsmiths because it was the closest university to the Crystal Palace National Sports Centre, because my life then was playing basketball and being an athlete. So my choice to come to Goldsmiths was completely unacademic, completely unthought through. You know, we'd think about what the choices that young teenagers making. We need to try and remember what it was like to be 18, actually. So I came here for that reason, and I'm here 40 years later. So I'd studied geography initially and hated it and was failing. I was still a professional athlete. I was on the edge of being thrown out. And a woman called Nikki Nelson, I should never forget it, came into a class introducing this thing called anthropology. And me and my mate, you know, we both felt a little bit like outsiders at that time, looked at each other and went, I don't know what this is. Well, let's just listen to what this is going to be. And I should never forget it. She came into the room. She's a very small American woman, very feisty, full of energy and life, with a shock of red hair, I remember, in those days, right past down her shoulders. And she said, I should never forget, she said, well, if rocks and strata make your heart beat faster, then anthropology isn't for you. And me and my mate looked at each other and went, okay, where do we join? And we put our hands up. And so I did a course in anthropology, and it completely blew my mind, you know, a course in human culture on a global scale, and an attention to the world that was trained not from a distance or through the library, but from physical, lived proximity. It really caught my imagination, you know, and I transferred to a joint anthropology and geography degree. And I just really fell in love with it. Was always a little bit uneasy and uncomfortable in the academic space, although, you know, fell in love with books, had to give up professional sport to finish my degree, which, you know, was a tough thing, as that was my dream, you know, to play for England, to play professional ball, you know. But I had to give that up. I went back to it later, actually, and funded the first year of my PhD for playing basketball. But at that time, I was failing as a student, and I had to, so I stopped, and I pulled my academic grades up. I didn't get thrown out, and I did reasonably well. Not as well as I might have done, but I did reasonably well. And then from there, I started to work as a community worker, youth worker, close by here in New Cross, in two youth clubs, one really very close to the college and another one down by the river. And it was at that time, the early 1980s, there was a real kind of both a tumult of political struggle in this part of London, but also a kind of renaissance of black expressive life. So on the one hand, this part of London was a place where the white nationalist National Front, as they were then, paraded through the streets as a provocation in 1977 to protest, in their terms, against mugging, which was being coded as a black crime, you know. It was a place where there was intense conflict, but at the same time, you know, Joe Gibbs, the Jamaican producer, had a record shop on the other side of the street from the college. You know, you turned right out of Goldsmiths College, and Eve Studios was a recording studio where reggae music was being made in London with a kind of London casting, sonically, that became this historic form called Lovers Rock. And Dennis Bovell, who's become a lifelong friend, actually, was the sound recording engineer in that studio. You know, the man who ran that studio is a fantastic man called Dennis Harris, who was the first black owner of a supermarket in this corner of London. That's where he earned his money, but he loved music, so he bought a recording studio and built it in the basement on Upper Broccoli Road, just up there, you know, 150 yards from where we're sitting. So at this part of London at that point was an incredible ferment of struggle, of politics, of and violence, and sometimes, you know, murderous violence, as well as creativity. You know, that year that I came to live in New Cross in 1981 was the year of the New Cross fire, where 13 young black people were killed in a house fire and a 14th died 2 years later. You know, those were just young kids. They were people, you know, as growing up as a white Southeast Londoner, they were the same age as me. You know, they could have been the kids sitting next to me in the class. And, you know, at that time, although the college itself was pretty dislocated from this incredible, you know, energy that was in this part of London culturally and politically, the college was like a white island in this incredible post-colonial sea. But that, walking past the house at 439 New Cross Road where those young people were killed, you know, a crime that's never been solved, an open wound in this part of London, but also a national, you know, a national stirring. Mm. You know, in the aftermath of that fire, there was a historic march called the Black People's Day of Action, which walked literally past the end of the street that we're sitting on here. Right. You know, and all of the intellectuals that came to really interpret what English and British culture is, you know, people like Paul Gilroy and Hazel Carby, you know, figures now who are global intellectual forces, were marching that day, as well as local young people and local families. It was led by John LaRose, who was a very important sort of post-colonial literary figure, but also political figure associated with what's referred to as the New Beacon Circle. All these events have been really kind of brought to life in Steve McQueen's film Small Axe recently. So the names of the people that I mentioned that American listeners might not know, they're all documented now beautifully and remembered, which is a wonderful thing through those films. But I was in the midst of that as a young white kid, you know, who was being drawn into this world and hosted by young black people, controlled by young black people. And I learned a tremendous amount from that experience. I probably learned more, to be honest with you, John, outside the college in those days than I did in the classroom. Although, you know, being in the classroom opened up a world of ideas that I'd never even dreamed of before. And in a sense, the 40 years from there to here has been really a task of trying to weave those different textures and experiences and ideas. And all of my projects are kind of made from that meshing, if you like.
Yeah. It feels like... It's interesting because you talked about anthropology and doing a PhD in anthropology, but you didn't... It felt like culture and everyday culture was... You were seeing it on the doorstep of the institution rather than thinking, I need to go to a country or a society that's away. You know, there was this need and decoding of culture and life that was existing here.
You know, it's very, 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 very perceptive, you know, as always from you, John. But, I mean, yeah, of course, that's anthropology happened somewhere else. You wrote about it and you read about it here in the classroom. But the action happened of fieldwork, of the magic of anthropological fieldwork. It happened on a distant shore. Whereas, you know, I was never really interested in that sense of travel because it felt like to me that there was a whole world that was, you know, a continent away, but it was next door. Mm. And the thing about that, what had made that incredible proximity and distance at the same time was not geography, it was imagination. And, you know, I think the university, you know, we talk about decolonizing knowledge now, and rightly. And in a way, all of the things I've tried to do have been trying to address that distance, if you like. But, you know, the truth is that the world of ideas was a universe, a continent away from the things that were happening next door. You know, our great friend, Professor Les Henry, as he is now, whose PhD I supervised many years later, was a dancehall DJ on Reggae Sound Systems. And, you know, there were regular dancers at 51 Lewisham Way, opposite where the anthropology department was. Next door to where the sociology, literally next door on Lewisham Way, the anthropology and the sociology department had no idea what was going on there. Yeah. You know, and in a way, Les's book, What the DJ Said, documents exactly both the importance and the urgency of that world. Why it mattered, you know, why actually those musical cultures was the difference between, you know, so that generation of really losing their minds, actually, as well as their hearts, and being able to cope and make sense and reason and reckon with the world that they were having to navigate, you know, a world of violent street racism, you know, murderous sometimes, as well as, you know, informal slights and also institutional forms of racism and white supremacy.
Yeah.
It's what it was, you know, but people were living it in the everyday level, and that's where I always thought there was something that was so powerful and rich. And if you were paying attention, if you were really listening and thinking, you couldn't but notice those extraordinary things that were happening all the time, everywhere, at the bus stop. You didn't need to go to a foreign shore. You just had to pay attention at the bus stop. And there was enough there for a lifetime of anthropological curiosity.
Yeah. I think that that's something you've used the word, if you could listen.
Yeah.
I think that's what you said. And I could pick up any of your books, and we could just sit here, and the content, the thinking would be relevant to any of the listeners listening to the podcast. There's one book, though, that has really stuck with me, and I've reread it for this podcast, and it's your book called The Art of Listening. And it taps into this, and it feels like it's part of my DNA, who I am as a person, and also as a professional, also an anthropologist in the business world. But what's the premise? Why did you write this book, The Art of Listening?
Well, there's a reason why I wrote it, John, that I'll tell you maybe in a few seconds, because I think it brings to life the urgency of it. But the premise of the book is that we live in a culture, and it doesn't matter if you're in the business world or if you're in the world of education or if you're in the world of, you know, the service industry. We live in a culture that speaks rather than listens. We're so quick to speak, you know, from the political class to, you know, the conversation in Costa Coffee that you overhear. We're so quick to want to speak. I don't think we live in a culture that listens well at all. I don't think we're trained to listen. Listening isn't an automatic faculty, I think. Listening is a disposition, something that needs to be tuned and trained. And so the book is called The Art of Listening because I think, at its best, the kinds of work that we do, now we can call it sociology, we could call it anthropology, frankly, I don't care what we call it. All of those things, I think, should have at their centre the vocation of listening. And so that's why I got to this point, because I had a bit of a sort of personal crossroads moment. You know, I know this is a place that you know well, but Mayday Hospital in Croydon was in South London, where I was born. My father, around the writing, just before I didn't really know that I was writing this book, but then I realised in the midst of the experience of sitting alongside my father, as he was, you know, in his last days, he died of cancer. He was a working class man who had a terrible fear of hospitals. His great fear was that he would die in hospital alone. You know, in a way, the hospital, in words that you'll recognise, aren't necessarily places where you think, in his generation, you know, he was born in the early part of the 20th century, he grew up during the 1930s, for his generation, the hospital wasn't necessarily a place of healing. The hospital was a place that you avoided like the plague. It was a dangerous place. And hospitals had the kind of, they were haunted by the institutional memory of other places, like the workhouse, where you were sent if you were, you know, your families couldn't pay their way, you were sent to the workhouse. And they had George Orwell's written brilliantly about this. He has a lovely essay called How the Poor Die. Anyway, he was terrified of hospitals. So I didn't want him to die alone, you know. So I sat with him through very long nights in Mayday Hospital, and he was unconscious, and, you know, the sound of his diminishing breaths and his rattling chest as his lungs filled, actually, you know, was the soundtrack of that experience. And what I did through that night was to take the proof copies of this book, The Art Out of Whiteness. So you can imagine, I've just reached up for this for the listeners. I'm reading the proof copy of this book. Like every author, you know, we live in fear of mistakes. So I'm reading the proof copies of the book I just finished, and I can hear the sound of my father's diminishing breaths. And it was a real moment of taking stock, really. I thought, what am I doing with this? What am I doing with this book? What's this for? What am I trying to do? Why might it matter? How do I want to try and make it matter? So the sort of people often say of that book, you know, you really put your cards on the table. Well, I did, because I felt like I needed to, you know, and it wasn't necessarily in memory of losing him, but his passing was the kind of shadow that is cast over the book. And there's several parts in it where I sort of weave in some of those, that time, why it made really made my it focused my mind in the way that it did. And really it came back to the simple question as well, what might the kind of work that we do be needed for in our time?
Right.
And that's really where the sort of the drive, if you like, and in a way all of the chapters that are in the book are exemplifications of and answers to that question.
Right, yeah. And I mean that's very powerful, because it has total relevance to, dumb this down, but the academic writing academic books needs to be academic, but you're also saying, I'm positioning it from a very personal experience, fundamentally, not just your father's death, but your father's fear of dying and your role in that space. And we often see this in the world of work or business, where I'm a professional, therefore I will only do everything.
Yeah.
But the personal can't come in.
Yeah.
It doesn't shape, or therefore you don't reflect on it. You're not empathetic to the big point. And so I can really see the power of that. You also mentioned in the book about this concept of the sociology or sociological listening.
Yeah.
And what is that? What is that?
Well, very good question, John. I mean, I think you're right. You know, I mean, I remember going to see my head of department after I'd finished the book. You know, I was going to publish it sooner, and then I wasn't happy with it. So I pulled it once and said, no, it's not ready. I need to work on it more. And then I went back to my head of department and said, you know, I've written this book. Thank you for giving me the time to do it. But I've written this book. I'm really not sure whether I should let it go. I mean, basically, I argue that sociology is a listener's art. You'd think people will laugh at me if I argue that. And it's written, as you say, with a different kind of register. I wanted it to be written with open prose. So anybody who would be interested in these issues, you know, either the issues that are dealt with in the book, from, you know, class to popular culture to the war on terror, it ranges across the whole, you know, different topics, could read it and get something from it, and written in a different kind of voice, because I didn't want to write it in a way that in a sense enclosed it within a kind of equivalent of, you know, medieval Latin. You know, scholars in the medieval period used to speak a different language. Mm. And in university campuses, everyone spoke Latin like they did in church. And I think we've got a kind of equivalent of medieval Latin now in the kind of academic jargon that we write and shorthand that we write, and it cuts people out. I didn't want to cut people out. I wanted to reach out. You know. Now, what is the difference between, you know, being a good listener and hearing a friend and being a sociological listener? I think the difference is simply this, you know, that you're listening for the big story of history, of society, of cultural formation, of institutional forms in the grain of the voice. You're listening for that story, because in the voice, the story that people are telling you is the trace of that larger historical story. So, you know, when I introduce where we are as saying, well, this is it was a swimming baths and a washhouse. Well, it was a swimming baths and a washhouse for a reason. Mm. The context of pandemic, a class divided city where, you know, families didn't have places to get clean, you know. No brainer, really, why there was an epidemic of infectious diseases in the high point of the industrial city, the imperial city. So, from the bathhouse, from the bath, to that big story of a imperial city, an industrial city like London, there's a connection. Mm. That's what sociological listening can do at its best.
And you also talk about sociological listening as a means of, I don't know if it's Pierre Bourdieu or something, but making the familiar strange.
Yes.
And what does that mean, making... I mean, you've kind of touched on it.
Yeah, no, see, I think that comes from very different points, you know, that, John, the idea of making the familiar strange. I mean, I see it in the anthropological training. There are traces of it there, you know, and in the writings of Clifford Geertz. It's definitely there in Bourdieu. It's there in all of the people that I admire the most, actually. It's there in somebody like Raymond Williams in cultural studies. Now, the thing is... You know, perhaps the best way for me to describe this is to tell a sort of funny story about a moment at the LSE. We have a sort of a connection to the LSE, a connection to the LSE, and I always, you know, I always come away thinking, south, head south, go back over the river where you belong. The LSE is in North London, in the heart of the Imperial City. It's called the London School of Economics for a reason. Not to be snide about it. Anyway, I remember going to a seminar there, and one of the professors in sociology said very grandly in the seminar, you know, the people are the experts in their own lives. Right? Little ripple of kind of radical approval. The people are the experts, not us. The people are. And I sort of sat there and thought, the people are the experts in their own lives? Okay. So if the people are the experts in their own lives, am I an expert in my own life? No. If we were experts in our own lives, we'd never fall out of love, we'd never make a mistake, we'd never be pushed around by the forces of history, we're not really knowing what they were, or these, you know. C. Wright Mills, one of my great sociological heroes, an American sociologist, who lived a very short life, but lived a very brilliantly bright one, you know, said that, you know, oftentimes people experience their private experiences of life feel like traps, feel like we're caught in these opaque social forces. You know, I'm not an expert in my own life. Why should we expect anyone else to be? So on the one hand, you know, I think Eric's understanding of life is experienced very up close, in a very intense way, and I think this is happening from the boardroom to the office, you know, to the shopping centre, wherever. We experience it in a very, very intimate, up-close way. We both are completely knowing of this world that's private and close and intimate. Yet at the same time, I think that world can often feel like, for many, as a trap and feel like a total mystery. Yeah. So in a way, we have to defamiliarise and start to see again. I mean, I use a lot the idea of re-enchant that which is familiar. We need to make it strange, we need to see it not as just the way things are, just natural, just normal. Nothing is natural or normal. You know, they're not, those circumstances aren't a product of nature, they're a product of history and of social circumstances. So we need to defamiliarize it. That's one really important step. But what I've been trying to do very consciously in the kinds of work that I do is then to take that lack of familiarity, because that defamiliarization can make people feel very uncomfortable and very disorientated. I think the next step is to re-enchant it. Mm. To re-enchant it, to invest it with meaning, with wonder, in a way that orientates the person who's trying to understand differently.
Goes back to your point about the bus stop. You know, if you stand at the bus stop, it's a bus stop that you use every day. But if you look around the bus stop or below the bus, there's a history to what's around you, with the 360, and it's about not just history, but there is a heartbeat that's there to be. Well, where does, so if this idea around making the familiar strange and keeping that, because it's very much about the everyday, it's not a snapshot, but it's understanding all different kind of ingredients to what we're looking at, right? History and other. Where does ethnography come as a people? I'm always reluctant to use the word methodology. I think it's a framework, it's a way of thinking. But where does the ethnographic approach come into this idea about making the familiar strange?
Okay, right. Well, I think I have an answer to this, John, and it's not that you just fed me the questions. But you know that I do. You know that I have an answer to this because, you know, I one of the things that I've kept with me from that those early days in anthropological training. You see, the thing, I'm the kind of guy, I'm part of what's called the lost generation, those people who were trained as anthropologists and never worked in it. You're kind of on the tail end of it, I think, too. So, you know, I loved anthropology. I completely was, it opened my mind. But I never had a job in anthropology because I wasn't strange enough. I didn't go far enough away. I wasn't exotic enough. In those days, the idea of doing anthropology at the bus stop was like, are you kidding me, aren't you, really? I mean, I had a lot of very painful experiences about trying to make things that people would easily dismiss as being trivial, you know, low class, you know, trashy in American sort of vernacular. Trying to take that seriously just didn't fit. So I couldn't have a life in anthropology. But the thing that I kept with me throughout everything I've done in the last 40 years since then is that sense of, well, we can only understand the familiar and make it strange from inside it. Mm-hmm. We have to get inside it. We have to go there. Now, that might be how we get the being there-ness of doing intellectual work changes now in our time of hyperconnection and the traffic and movement of information. But I think ethnography is premised on the idea of an intense commitment to proximity, to go, as Robert Capus said once, you know, go as close as you can, photographer, and make your image, and then come away. Mm-hmm. Get as close as you dare, Capa would say. And I think the ethnographic vocation and craft is, that should be its first impulse, to get as close as we dare to that thing which we want to understand, and try to understand it, not just through the way in which people talk about it. You know, sociology is the science of the interview. Mm-hmm. People do interviews. It's like Pavlovian. But I think anthropologists want to document life unfolding in living. Mm-hmm. You know, in many ways, those documents are a bit like epitaphs to life unfolding in living, because they've lived once and that they may not replicate themselves. There may be patterns of replication. But they are like epitaphs to a life that's unfolding, and you document them. That's what anthropologists write in our beloved field notebooks.
Yeah.
Those epitaphs to life unfolding in the process of living.
That's fantastic. It reminds me, I think it is Bourdieu who came up with the idea of social silence. And Gillian Tett, in her recent book, Anthrovision, she's Financial Times with a background, a PhD in anthropology, she speaks about how that helped her as a journalist, but with the anthropologist's mind. And she was on a top American news show when Trump was just about to, you know, was campaigning, and he used the word bigly, and that was all laughed at, and everyone laughed. It was the academic, you know, Latin speaking, and he didn't know what he was. And then she was advised to look the other way, and to, and if you are understanding Trump, you need to understand wrestling. And that's, she went as close, and she started to listen to the social, that was social silence, because it wasn't part of the, and she realised actually what he was doing, he was talking to a different person, which was amazing how she's documented that. Mm. And she's been, you know, labelled as the one person who predicted Trump would win, because she listened to social silence. There's also something about this, the notion of listening, and the sociological, you know, listening. Are we listening to just words, or are we also listening to this idea of silence and silence actually being very noisy? Is listening part of the body? Is it about the space, the place, the design, the structure? What, you know, can we go that abstract?
Well, I don't think it's necessarily abstract. Yeah, of course, we must go there. Mm-hmm. We must go there because, you know, you know, I call my book The Art of Listening because I feel it is important to attend to what people say. But the important things in life are not only captured in what people say through language. Mm-hmm. You know, sometimes the most important things in life are not spoken. they remain unspoken, unnarrated, and it's one of the Zygmunt Bauman's great insights. You know, he says, you know, isn't it true that the most important things in life remain unsaid? So listening is a kind of beginning point for me, really. I guess in a way what I'm arguing for is a sort of attentiveness that can notice and document and take seriously those forms of human experience that are both articulated through language and are spoken, but also are unspoken, that are embodied. Mm-hmm. You know, there's one of the chapters in that book that is beloved by lots of people is the one that's about tattooing. It's precisely about what can't be spoken and how people use their bodies as a canvas. That was written before the tattooing renaissance, you know, or as it's called now. And when tattoos were like things you didn't do, or if you did, you marked yourself in a stigmatic kind of way. It's got to be, I think, trying to think within what Joachim Berendt calls a democracy of the senses.
Yeah.
So it's not just sound, it's not just language, it's not just logos, it's about sensuousness, it's about feel and touch. And our experience of moving through space as well, you know, the context of life. So yeah, I guess I'm arguing that it's not just an art of listening, but a vocation of attentiveness, okay, of being attentive to those things. Because often the important issues that we're trying to make sense of are contained in they're close, they're all around us, they're mysterious. That's why we need to make them strange in order to understand them. But also, you know, we need a kind of capacity for attention that can admit those things so that we can develop movements of imagination to try and make sense of them.
Yeah. That you use the term, which I love, listening more carefully, which feels like it kind of really that succinctly frames what you're talking about there. And I could take you to any business school and we could sit in on a lecture about the importance of storytelling. Why leaders must be able to tell stories. And it's very much around communication. And it's, you know, you could think, well, this is challenging the boundaries of what business should be about. But they often, I think, get it wrong. They don't understand what a story is. And from, I think, and you can tell me if I'm wrong here, but the anthropological, the sociological, I think it was Michael Jackson, the anthropologist, talks about stories as the blood vessels of culture. So actually, culture exists because of stories. Mm. Not necessarily just the verbal story, but the Goffman performance, the way we hold the body, the way who sits where in a meeting, they're all stories. And it's about the embodiment, about how we... And there's something quite beautiful but important there that, around that. So it's... I also want to... You also mentioned, and this is something I think that we see, or I definitely see in my kind of work as a term being used, but again, often misunderstood. But I'm going to read out a quote from your book around active listening, which I found very helpful. So active listening challenges the listener's preconceptions and position, while at the same time it engages critically with the content of what is being said and heard. And I think that that's... Can you just tell me a bit more about what...
Yeah.
About this notion of active listening?
Well, that's why that professor at the LSE is a fool, you know. It's not that people are experts in their own life and they can simply just, we can just, you know, write it down and then just tell the story.
Yeah.
We have to engage critically with the contents of the story. What can be spoken? What is unspoken? Mm-hmm. What claims are being made in the story? What kind of authority does the story write into itself? Is the story one that's told over and over and over and over and over again?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Just the fact that the story is told in the same pattern, something to do with the interests of the teller and the people that are connected to the teller, him or herself, mm-hmm. that are like the teller in some sort of social or cultural way.
Yes.
You know, so I think that's why it's not simply a matter of, you know, absorbing the truth of life through listening. It's not that straightforward. We have to develop and foster a kind of critical engagement with the content of what we document through this attentiveness that I'm arguing for. Because I think, you know, at the end of the day, this is an argument for why the kinds of work that I see in my students and colleagues matters and is valuable. But actually, that's not the only aim that I'm looking for. You know, I'm saying that actually these modes are a way not only to conduct research, they're a better way to live. And that's where I got a little bit nervous. I'm saying this is a better way to live. Mm. This isn't just one. This is a better way to live.
So it's actually breaking it out of the. I mean, because that's out of the academic thing, but actually, this is how we should be.
Yeah.
And this is really potent with the work I do. I think in organisations and that this is actually how people who've got authority, got power, need to also be.
Absolutely.
And there's something very the word empathy or the term empathy is currently, I think, being used as this kind of utopian totem pole of engagement and things like that, but I think it's much more profound.
No, I think so. You know, I think all of these, this is something that I've thought about a lot, John, all of these words that we may use as kind of, as almost like flags of value, empathy, listening, they can all be debased. That's the nature of the world that we live in. All of these words that can be agents for a different sort of world, can easily be incorporated by those interests that actually want to shut these things down. You know, listening can be utterly coercive. It can be oppressive. It can be cruel. I hear you. So you can talk. I'm not going to do anything about it.
Yeah.
You know, the silence of the therapist can feel really cool too, actually. Yeah. Just that I'm not going to say anything. I'm just going to leave you hanging in your own words, you know. It can be really cruel, actually. So all of these things involve sometimes destabilizing and complex relations, these practices. So I'm not saying this is an easy way to live. I'm not saying that at all. I think it's a better way to live, both ethically, morally, and also socially. But I'm not saying it's easy. I'm saying it's actually this means you're going to have to deal with some
challenge.
You're going to have to deal with some challenges. Mm. You're going to have to be. You're going to have to open yourself to the challenges of what it means to really hear. To really hear those things you'd rather not hear.
Yeah.
So I don't think it's as simple or easy. And you know, I find this in the classroom as well. Sometimes it's really destabilizing to practice this craft. It unsettles. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's partly why, you know, I've been really pushing for this idea. Well, it's not just the defamiliarization, the unsettling of the familiar. It's also the re-enchantment. It's putting back together your way of being in the world and operating too. So I think that's very important. I mean, there's another aspect to this that it would be good to talk about because, you know, listening is something I want to argue for, and this attentiveness is something I think is the best lesson that comes out of the craft of scholarship. But it can be a curse because you have to live with what you've heard. And sometimes that's difficult and troubling. And I'm trying to write something at the moment called The Listener's Curse.
Okay.
Which I think, you know, I think doctors would recognise that. I think lots of caring professionals recognise that. I think healthcare professionals really recognise it. So, you know, on the one hand, you know, there's a reason why healthcare professionals have supervision. Social workers have supervisors. Because they have to absorb and listen to and hold sometimes quite difficult realities.
Yeah.
So, you know, I'm not saying this is an easy practice at all. I'm saying it's an absolutely worthwhile one. And in a way, I think the world would be a better place if we lived less with the spoken certainties and more with the listened doubts. The world would be a better place if the balance was tipped. And in a way, that's what my book tries to do, is say maybe we need to try in small ways or big ways to tip that balance or rebalance.
Which is interesting, I think, what we're seeing in that last few years. And I know a professor of politics here, Will Davis, has written about happiness and the happiness industry, where we're sidestepping it by kind of trying to have shots in our arm of well-being, happiness, without necessarily having to address the challenge.
Yeah.
You know, this. You wrote the book in 2007, financial crisis, a lot going on, and your personal experience with your father as well. I'm just thinking, if we take a snapshot of the last few years, I've just written here, COVID, notions of work and security, racism, football, Black Lives Matter, the Me Too movement, LGBTQ plus, you know, debates around gender and gender identity, and the environment, COP26 last week, and of course in the UK, Brexit, not just the UK, but Europe, Brexit.
Yeah.
So where does the notion of the art of listening exist now?
Well, you know, I don't want to be too pleased with myself, John, you know. I don't. I really don't. You know, that's not my... That's the last thing I want to be is another arrogant academic, you know, in the world. But, you know, I do think, God, you take a lot of those things and you think, we live in a world that suffers from certainty rather than doubt. Trump, Brexit. You know, God, the years that have followed have been like a festival of certainty, haven't they? Or false, what I would say, false certainties that cover over or repress the kind of welter of doubts and difficulties and challenges that our world contains, you know. Just cover them up with, you know, it's about those folk over the border, or it would be okay if we could just control immigration. You know, those are the sorts of certainties that I think that the political culture trades in and continues to trade in. I mean, the anti-vaxxers. I mean, the figure of Eric Clapton. I mean, my God, he ties it all together. You know, this kind of tirade, anti-vaxxing tirade. The way in which that sort of those populist certainties, both on the one hand, carry sentiment and carry people who believe in them in a situation which completely turns away from the complex reality and difficult realities of how to live in and through a pandemic. So, you know, partly I think, wow, that formulation about certainty, God, we've seen a lot of that. I think we can only make sense of all of those issues, all of those movements, all of that extraordinary range of things that have happened through developing an attentiveness to the world that takes those things in and really thinks with them carefully, not in a way that just accepts the claims that are being made, but also critically engages with them, tries to weigh them. You know, we also live in a time where information circulates an unprecedented frequency and scale. The movement through our screens, through our phones, the movement of information, the proliferation of information. We're generating data all the time, every time we make a purchase. You know, there are vast commercial databases that are collecting profiles of each of us all the time. I think one of the things that the art of listening or the vocation of attentiveness that I'm interested in can help people weigh that information, you know, to try and make sense of it.
Yeah.
To try and ask critical questions about what truth is. You know, we need to pay truth the serious of the courtesy of serious effort. That's another one of my slogans in the book. I think we do.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, it's about trying to equip people with the capacity to think carefully and critically about knowledge and data, what data signifies, what it contains. So, you know, it seems to me that though the arguments that were being made really at the beginning of the 21st century seem even more urgent now. You know, the book that I wrote subsequently, which was published in 2013, is a book called Migrant City, which takes all of those sort of general aspirations and applies it to the experience of, you know, 30 young adult migrants growing up in London over a period of 10 years. It's a study that was done jointly with a friend of mine, Shamsha Sinha, and some of the participants who were what we would call informants as anthropologists became authors as part of that process. And it's just been published in Japan. It's been translated into Japanese. And one of the things that we have done subsequent to the publication of the book and the emergence of the translation is to go back to people and ask them about the experience of the pandemic from the vantage point of being, you know, a young adult migrant in London. One of the women involved in the project is a woman called Charlene Bryan, whose name is on the cover as one of the sort of participant authors of the book. And she said something that really, I don't know, it just kind of burned through into my mind about what the experience of the pandemic had been for her. And she had said, well, you know, from her point of view, the experience of the pandemic, living through the pandemic in London, was an intense experience of the proximity of life and death. You know, so on the one hand, the fear of death, the fear of premature death, you know, and it's true to say that black and brown communities in this city have been more prone to death than their rich white counterparts. So the fear of death can drive phobic reactions, the fear of the stranger. She talked about, you know, the way people recoiled when she coughed at Whitechapel Tuesday. It can make us phobic and fearful. Keep out the stranger. Keep away from the strange. That can be one driver of the fear of death. But another driver of the fear of death can be the embrace of life and to know that we are weaker alone. We are weaker in isolation. And she talked about the way in which she came to value the connections and the forms of community that were established across differences. As part of being involved in the project, Charlene's become a published author. She's a poet, you know. She wrote poems as data for the project. They were extraordinary. We did the kind of anthropological analysis of those poems with her. But she talked about the poetry circle, which, you know, contains people from Syria, from Pakistan, along with, you know, British Asian Londoners and Caribbean black Londoners, Caribbean people from Jamaica and so on, who are writing together through the dubious magic of the screen and Zoom, but still connected and now meeting. So it, for her, you know, the pandemic, the lesson was, well, okay, which one of those impulses that the thought of death and the fear of the pandemic, which one do you invest in?
Yeah.
How do you shape a life in the face of that?
Liz, we're going to come to the end. This is part one. We're going to be recording a second podcast, part two, on the sociology of walking. And yes, I think the two of them, of the listening and the walking, are going to collide beautifully together. And it's in that second podcast I'll be asking you about the anthropologist notebook as well.
Oh, yeah. But I've got an answer for you there, John.
We'll be asking it in the second one, but thank you so much.
It's a total pleasure. Thank you.
It's great.
Thanks for listening to the Decoding Culture podcast. I hope that you found part one of my chat with Professor Back interesting and can start to incorporate the principles of the art of listening into your everyday work. Part two will add to many of the points discussed by exploring sociological walking. If you're interested in more how anthropology adds value to organizational culture and change, I'm running my 5-week training program for the fifth time in partnership with EPIC. It is called Leveraging Organizational Culture for Impact, and it starts in January 2022. I'll put the details of the course content on the show notes, plus also a lot of Les Back's publications, which are fantastic. Please do subscribe to the podcast feed and feel free to give the podcast a rating on iTunes. To keep up to date with interesting trends on culture, business and anthropology, sign up to my Decoding Culture newsletter. The link will also be in the show notes. See you next time.